During the ASCA meeting, I met with Dr. Luis Paz Ares, and after hearing a lot over the past year about inhibitors of MET, I was curious where he thinks this strategy is heading. And to begin, he commented on an ASCO paper at this year's ongoing trial session describing a phase 3 study of the anti-MET monoclonal antibody MetMab.
So this trial, actually, what is being presented here is the design of the phase 3 and actually mirrors the phase 2. The only difference is that here only MET high expressors, patients with tumor that express MET at high level, would be included into the trial. And the nice thing is a well-powered trial, number of patients are enough, and randomization could be to erlotinib versus erlotinib plus MetMab in the second-line setting.
And what do we know right now about this monoclonal antibody, particularly in terms of what side effects and toxicity it brings to the table?
Right. I mean, in the phase 2, the side effects were not great, to be honest. There were some side effects, particularly some edema, which seems to be kind of a class effect. And there were some other side effects, but I would say mild in terms of nausea, vomiting, etc. But there were no major toxicity. There were not a clear increase in toxicity in combination with erlotinib as compared to the erlotinib alone arm.
And what's the thinking by combining erlotinib and MetMab in a wild-type patient?
Well, I mean, the idea would be, easily speaking, that you have two motorways to go to a place. You actually stop transit by one motorway. Maybe you do nothing. You stop both at the same time. Maybe you're doing something. Particularly in those tumor cells that are not depending on a driving signaling. This is the reason, maybe important, on those tumor cells to block two or three signal pathways. And what we know so far is that a number of patients with the mutations, about 10 to 20% of the tumors, may develop a MET amplification after treatment with erlotinib or defitinib as a resistant mechanism. And in fact, a similar proportion of patients may have an autocrine or paracrine increase on the hepatocyte growth factor levels, the natural ligand of MET. And I would expect that maybe there is a role for this type of agents in EGFR mutants, but possibly the type of trial you should do is not quite the same in terms of design.
Are there any interest in looking at MetMab by itself or MetMab with any other agent?
Okay, I think that is true. It would be very logical to look at the agent on its own on very specific populations, on tumors actually addicted to the MET signaling. That could be a MET-amplified gastric cancer or a papillary renal cell carcinoma with MET mutations, germline. There are some other rare tumors that sporadically have MET mutations, including not very frequently, but sometimes some forms of lung cancer. And maybe those are the tumor types where it makes sense to prove at some point MetMab as a single agent. On the other hand, it could be a number of combinations that would be worthy to do, including chemotherapy, also some targeted agents, particularly in, let's say, renal cell carcinoma.
Can you talk a little bit about the agent ARC-197, tivatinib?
So this is another MET inhibitor. Not a monoclonal, but a small molecule, so a kinase inhibitor. The drug have shown some activity on a randomized phase 2 trial in combination with erlotinib, also on EGFR wild types. The drug has been taken into a phase 3 trial in non-small cell lung cancer. Within the inclusion criteria, they didn't ask for MET expression in the tumor, but they were collecting tissues so that they could kind of do the biomarker analysis in retrospect. The trial was really well powered, more than 100 patients, and finished recruitment some weeks ago. So I would say that maybe in a year and a half time, we may have the results ready.
Have you had any patients on trials with that agent?
Yeah. I've treated some 15, 17 patients in a trial.
What have you observed in terms of toxicity?
Toxicity-wise, the drug is fine. It's not easy to say the patient was on erlotinib alone or an erlotinib plus the drug. Of course, you're getting some patients with more severe skin tox, and you don't know if it's erlotinib alone or erlotinib plus the ARC-197 compound. But I wouldn't say no severe increase in toxicity.
Has there been any interest in doing a trial looking at the monoclonal antibody combined with a TKI?
That would be something with some logics, particularly in tumors with a lot of MET signaling. In fact, this has been done with the EGFR signaling pathway, combining TKI plus monoclonals, and the results had been quite encouraging in some patient contexts.
I guess, are you talking about the cetuximab afatinib strategy?
Absolutely. That's
it's really fascinating.
Absolutely.
Is there any new data on that? I guess we saw some data on that last year.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing I know is that they were planning phase two trial on that, but I couldn't say anymore at the present time.
You are doing an important presentation here. You've already published the Paramount study. Now you're going to present more data. Where are we in terms of that question and anything else that's being presented here or recently in terms of the whole question of maintenance?
So we are presenting here the phase three final analysis on OS. The statistical analysis plan asks for at least 290 events, and we are having, at the time of the analysis, 397.
Could you just review the design of the study?
The study was a randomized phase three trial that was asking for the role of pemetrexed as a continuation maintenance in patients that had received cisplatin plus pemetrexed as an induction treatment. Therefore, typically patients with non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer were offered to enter in this study, which consisted of an induction part where all patients were receiving cisplatin plus pemetrexed for four courses. At the end of these four courses, patients without disease progression, that means responders or patients on stable disease, were offered randomization on a 2-to-1 fashion to continuation maintenance with pemetrexed versus placebo.
I'm kind of curious, when you first thought about this trial and talked about this trial, did you think you were going to see what you ended up seeing?
Well, to be honest, I have some hints about that. And I'm telling you, you look at the trials with continuation maintenance with other chemotherapy agents such as gemcitabine and so on, the hazard ratio for PFS was quite good. They never quite reached survival because the continuation maintenance trials, they were not well powered. All trials had included less than 300 patients. So I think that the PFS hazard ratio was not any worse as compared to the switch maintenance. The problem is that before this trial, no trial was positive in OS because of the low power of the design. So on the other hand, I thought that was more intuitive. So if you ask our colleagues doing breast cancer or colorectal cancer, what they do, they treat patients with a doublet or even a triplet, such as FOLFOX plus or less a monoclonal antibody. And then after a few months, 4 to 6 months, they get rid of the platinum agent, oxaliplatin, because of cumulative toxicity, and they just go on the fluoropyrimidine plus or less the monoclonal antibody. And you go to the breast cancer doctors, they do the same. They never stop chemo after 6 courses. We have to do that before in lung cancer because our agents were too toxic. But now we got some agent that with a better toxicity profile, so I think it was worth it. Because the question is, you have an agent that is giving you some efficacy, why you should stop it before this is progression? If you're tolerating nicely the drug, I think you should try to squeeze the benefit you can still extract from this drug.
I guess one of the thoughts that came out initially when these maintenance trials first started coming out was, could you just observe the patient and try to treat second line, you know, a little bit earlier?
Okay. Well, the problem is that is true when you speak about switch maintenance, but here is continuation maintenance. So your patient, you stop a treatment, and the patient has disease progression 3 or 5 months later. You never go back to the same agents. You go to a different agent. So what are we talking here is about squeezing the benefit. So I think there's still some benefit there, and that was the reason.
What are you presenting here?
I presented here the final overall survival results. Mainly, it confirms the results of PFS, and the results of the interim analysis on survival previously done.
So what's the hazard ratio?
0.78. So that means median survival improves from 11 months to 14 months from the randomization. If you start measuring from induction, you're improving median survival from 14 months to 17 months.
Do you think that the maintenance question is sort of completed? And there's an ECOG trial out there looking at maintenance. I'm not sure if there are other trials out there.
So what I think is this trial showing that you may still benefit further from some of the agents you use in the induction. Doesn't say every single patient should receive it. But I think you should comment with your patient about the potential benefit or going on permetested after cycle 4 of CISPEM. And that is what it's all about in this trial. I think there's still some question coming, like, is bevacizumab needed? Is that needed in induction, in a maintenance? Should we do it in combination or not with permetested? I think there's still some question to be solved.
What do you do in your own practice outside a trial setting? And one sort of basic question is, do you use CIS or CARBO?
Well, I'm using CIS, to be honest.
And how do you find it? I mean, a lot of people use CARBO in the metastatic setting because of concerns of toxicity. Why do you use CIS?
Well, you know, there is a meta-analysis showing that there is some survival benefit for patients treated with cisplatin, particularly on adenos, particularly while using third-generation regimens. This has been on summarized data, but also on individual patient data, the meta-analysis by Ardiccioni. And I think at the present time, cisplatin is not such a tough drug as it was in the past. We're doing always outpatient, and I think tolerance is not bad.
So again, outside of protocol setting in your own practice, what about Bev?
So the thing is, Bev, I think, is an alternative. And I may use it in some of the patients. The thing is, I'm not so convinced about the use of Beva with CIS-GEM, which is the current indication, because the ABAIL data are not very supportive. I do have more tendency to use it with carbotaxol.
You said CIS-GEM or CIS-PEM?
CIS-GEM, but there were two phase 3 trials with Beva. One was with carbotaxol, the American trial, showing clear benefit. And there was another trial with CIS-GEM, mainly Europe, being positive for PFS, but not for survival. And overall, the hazard ratio is 0.9 of two trials. Of course, I think there is a role for anti-angiogenic therapy, particularly with bevacizumab in lung cancer. But it is my own opinion that maybe carbotaxol is a better regime to give it as compared to CIS-GEM. There are some preclinical data suggesting taxanes may be better partners. The data that had been generated on phase 2 trial with pemetrexed are also encouraging. in particular, the ABAPEL data are absolutely encouraging.
Can you explain what that looked at?
So the ABAPEL trial had an induction phase of CIS-PEM plus BIVA, and then after four courses, non-progressing patients were randomized to BIVA alone versus PEM plus BIVA, and the results were really encouraging. PFS from randomization was 7 months versus 3.5 months, favoring the combination of PEM plus BIVA with a hazard ratio of about 0.5. If you start counting from the initiation of induction treatment, PFS was 10 months for patients treated on maintenance PEM plus BIVA, as compared to 7 months on the control arm. And I think those results are something very strong and very robust for non-small cell lung cancer patients. Just to remember in you, we are really happy about a PFS of 9 to 10 months in EGFR mutants, which is 15 to 20% of the patients.
Could you comment on the so-called Point Break trial and the Patel regimen, what that's looking at? I guess we're hoping we're going to see some results pretty soon on that.
Yeah, I think this trial also finished accrual. So we hope to see some results maybe in the second half of the year. In this trial, they compared two strategies. So patients in one arm are treated with the conventional ECOG regime, carboplatin plus BIVA, and then continuation maintenance with BIVA alone. The experimental arm here use carboplatin, pemetrexed plus BIVA, and then maintenance includes pemetrexed plus BIVA. So there are some differences in the induction arm, Taxol in one arm, pemetrexed on the other, and there were also differences on the maintenance arm. BIVA alone in one arm, pemetrexed plus BIVA on the other. I think that's a very interesting trial. The only risk is if the results are different in the different treatment arms, we'll never quite know where the difference is on the induction, on the maintenance phase, or in both of them.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I'm not sure of exactly all the thought involved, but I know right now a lot of investigators and, for that matter, physicians in practice are using that sort of Patel kind of regimen, at least at this point, until we see the trial results. What are your thoughts about that regimen outside a trial setting?
I mean, to be honest, I really like the regimen. I think toxicity-wise is something very acceptable, and the results are quite encouraging. Of course, that would depend very much on the context you're practicing. For example, in my country, this regime is not reimbursed, and that's something you have to take into account.
Let's talk about a few of your cases. We haven't talked much about EGFR mutations, so why don't we start with your case number 4, your 78-year-old lady.
Okay, so that was one of the first patients that actually treated with erlotinib, knowing the patient was mutated. She was actually the mother of one of my colleagues in the hospital. So she came to us.
That sounds like a tough situation for you.
Yeah. So she came to us, and she was just diagnosed of a stage 4 disease, adenocarcinoma of the lung. She had never smoked, and very much his son, who was a surgeon of my hospital, was kind of asking me, well, I'm pretty sure you're okay with that. I just think we shouldn't treat my mom.
She was in otherwise good health?
She was in really good health, but, you know, she was a widow, living alone, so the family was a bit concerned. Well, chemotherapy is not doing much in lung cancer. She's still alone. She was not particularly symptomatic at the time.
How did she actually present?
She actually presented with pain from a bone metastasis on the right hip. Then they discovered a couple of lung nodules. They were able to biopsy one of them. That was an adenocarcinoma. When she came to me, I asked for the mutation status and also ask for a brain MRI and actually discovers he had more than 20 very, very tiny small metastases.
Now, had they done a core biopsy that you could get?
Yeah.
But had they done a mutation test on her?
So no, not at the time, but at the time she came to me, I really performed it. So that was like 2006. And so I take advantage at the time of a trial I had opened with erlotinib, where we have a strata for patients first line with EGFR mutation.
Was this the EURTAC trial?
No, that was the predecessor of the EURTAC trial.
So 2006, I mean, EGFR mutation was discovered in 2004. How did you get the test done in 2006?
Okay, well, absolutely. We were really, very soon after the New England publication, we start to do that in Spain. And just to give you an idea, I presented in ASCO 2006 a phase 2 trial on an oral presentation, a phase 2 trial of erlotinib mutated patients.
Wow.
And she was one of the patients included in this trial.
Wow. So she has multiple brain mets, bone mets, and these lung lesions. The family's saying, you know, she's old. And then you say, well, how about erlotinib?
Yeah. So, no, I asked her then, okay, let's wait a minute. Let's go and do this genetic test. And a week later, they came back to the clinic, I had the result, the tumor was EGFR mutated, and then offered them to enter into this trial with single agent erlotinib.
And did she get brain radiation?
No, because she was asymptomatic. So we treated her with erlotinib. She had a fantastic response, including a response on the brain mets.
Wow.
And she had been on treatment for about 2.5 years before disease progression.
And how did she do on the erlotinib in terms of toxicity?
She was most of the time fine. At some point, she could have grade 1, even grade 2 rash. Also some days of mild diarrhea. She really learned how to control with the corticosteroid creams and maybe some cycles at some points of oral antibiotics.
She stayed on 150?
She stayed in 150 for about 2 years, and then we decreased over the last 6 months to 100 milligrams.
Just out of curiosity, if you were to see a patient like that again today, would you still start at 150 off trial?
Absolutely.
And how low can you go in a patient with a mutation and feel comfortable that you're still getting some possibility?
So, you know, the background behind your question is really logical. Maybe for many patients, particularly for exon 19 mutants, you don't need the full dose. The only thing I really like before I started doing that, to have a bit more data collected, I don't think there are enough. So what I'm trying to do is if the patient is having toxicity, I decrease the dose. If he or she is doing fine, I don't.
So you had mentioned she had bone pain. Did that get better?
Absolutely. That's one of the good things of having an early response that typically the patient improves very much on symptoms.
So she didn't need radiation to the bone?
No, not at all.
And then what happened when she progressed? How does that manifest?
Okay, so actually she progressed within the lung. And this is quite typical because 90% of the patients really progress in the lung. We have some doubts about some increasing one of the brain mets, so we really irradiate the brain at the time of disease progression. After doing that, we started the patient on a chemotherapy combination. And
which one?
Carbogenzyramine at the time. And I still include erlotinib on an intermittent schedule, day 2 to 15.
Day 2 to 15, same dose?
Yep.
Okay.
So the patient was having kind of a response, not meeting RECIST criteria. She was okay for a while, maybe 8 to 10 months, and then disease progression again. The patient entered a trial we had open at a time with sorafenib, and a few months later had disease progression again, received some radiation as a palliation, and then was sent to hospice when she really was feeling not very well. So at the end, the patient had some 4 years, being most of the time in good shape after diagnosis.
What was the patient and the family's response to this whole experience?
Actually, the patient was really, you know, a bit overwhelmed about the situation at the beginning. She didn't know nothing about cancer, particularly lung cancer. She had this idea that that was typically a disease affecting mainly males, particularly smokers. So she didn't understand what happened, why that happened to her. The family, as I told you, her son was a doctor, a surgeon. He was not very much into oncology, so he was really surprised about having such a fantastic drug that really improved the health of her mom and at the same time didn't associate with many side effects. So they were really fascinated about that.
Where are we right now in terms of targetable mutations in non-small cell? Maybe you can comment a little bit about EML4-ALK, ROS1, and now there's some kind of RET gene or something.
So the good thing is that at the present time, we are able to identify a bit more than a driving molecular normality in more than 50% of our patients. Of those, many, maybe half, are targetable. Of course, we talked already about EGFR mutants, but there is some other 5% of the patients, maybe 3%, that they have translocation of EML4-ALK. Those patients do have a constitutive activation of the ALK kinase within their tumors and is the driving force. And those patients do respond quite well to crizotinib. As we commented before, there are some other new ALK inhibitors for those patients. And also we have evidence that upon disease progression, this patient may respond quite well to heat shock protein 90 inhibitors. There are some other group of patients, some 1 to 2% of the adenocarcinomas, particularly in never smokers, they had HER2 mutations, and it seems that those patients do respond to trastuzumab, lapatinib, etc.
So objective responses?
Absolutely.
And again, to anti-HER therapy without chemo?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And these are mutations.
So I'm talking about mutation because it seems that at least trastuzumab is not doing much on amplification combined or not with chemo. It seems that some 1% of the patient may also have translocation of the ROS gene, and those patients had recently been identified to respond to crizotinib as well.
So I want to finish our discussion by talking a little bit about adjuvant treatment and treatment of stage 3 disease. I know you gave a patient, but let's just kind of focus on your general treatment patterns. First, how do you generally approach non-protocol adjuvant treatment decisions?
Okay. So, of course, something very important in this setting is how the patient is, the health status. I mean, we know that some 20 to 30% of the patients are never candidates to adjuvant chemo after surgery. The reason being some other comorbidities, but also some complication of surgery. Some patients are actually arriving to us maybe 3 months later after surgery, so it's a bit too late. The second thing, of course, we are taking into account are the pathological stages. So we are not offering this for stage 1A patients, and we do typically to stage 2 or 3. And in stage 1B, of course, we discuss the data with the patients, particularly in tumors that are higher than 4 centimeters. We tend maybe not to give it to a patient which is elderly, with cardiac disease, and a tumor which is lower than 3 centimeters. And we tend to give chemo on patients that are 50 years old, good health status, and a tumor that is 5 centimeters.
And what about choice of agents?
Okay, that's an issue because the chemo we are sure is working is cisplatin plus binoralin. The problem, this is not, let's say, our choice in stage 3B and 4. And quite often, I don't know how well we are doing, but quite often we actually translate the result of the stage 3B and 4 to the adjuvant setting because we feel some other regimes may be better tolerated or maybe most efficacious.
So 65-year-old person with stage 2 adenocarcinoma outside a trial setting, what are you most likely to try to treat with?
I will speak with the patient, and cisvinorelbine may be an option, and maybe in some cases after speaking with the patient, maybe cispem could be an option as well.
Let's talk about, we'll finish out talking about stage 3 disease. Again, how do you approach these patients?
Okay, so we have here two different subsets of patients, the theoretically resectable disease patient and the others without chances of being cured by surgery. So if a patient is having, let's say, stage 3B, our typical approach is to look at the patient in the medical oncology, but also in the radiation oncology at the beginning. So we plan the patient would be or not a candidate for chemoradiation. If he's not a candidate to chemoradiation because the volume should be too high or whatever, so we then start chemo and could have radiation with or without chemo thereafter.
When you do use chemo, either before or during, again, how do you choose?
So if we are doing chemoradiation, we use cisplatin etoposide plus chemo, plus radiation. If we are doing chemo and then consolidation with radiotherapy, we typically use cispem regime or a cisgem, depending on the histology, and then radiation if the patient is in good health and we feel maybe candidate for chemoradiation consolidation, we tend to use cis etoposide in the benefit patients again. If not, we may use the same regime we were using or cisplatin alone.